Welcome to Red Meat, the conservative news update you need from Odyssey stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, with no end in sight for the Iran war. A battle that, not for nothing, seemed to come out of nowhere for most Americans until gas started costing $5 a gallon. How do we get out of it? Let's check in with Mark Cox.
The mantra you would hear dripping from the lips of generals and with a serious look on their face was, "Our diversity is our strength," which is the single dumbest phrase in military history. Of course, our diversity is not our strength. Our unity is our strength, our shared purpose, the flag we wear and who we and the Constitution we serve to defend.
Yeah, Pete Hegseth there yesterday talking to the United States senators. And boy, that got a little heated yesterday. He was talking to Tammy Duckworth, who accused him of hating women. And I mean, it just it got off the rails. The point that he was there for, though, is obviously what's going on in Iran right now. And normally we would have J.J. Carafano joining us on a Friday morning. But Steve Bucci's been kind enough from the Heritage Foundation, visiting fellow focusing on cybersecurity and military special ops. Steve, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Great. Great to get you on here. And, you know, I'm listening to the president's comments, and I think I might have heard General Keane say yesterday on Fox News that he would not be surprised to see military operations resume over there soon.
I would agree with General Keane completely. The Iranians are not good faith negotiating partners, any of them. The civilians, definitely not the IRGC. President Trump has gone more than the extra mile to try and do this with negotiations. It's now time to say, okay, you had your chance. Now we're going to go back and we're going to finish this kinetically. They can do that by more direct targeting of the IRGC leadership, because I do think they're the biggest part of the problem. And they're the ones with the guns. And then I think the next thing they ought to do is more directly target every small boat that leaves the coastline of Iran going out into the Straits of Hormuz or the Persian Gulf. All of them right now are being used by the IRGC, whether they're their Boston whalers or just local skiffs that they've hooked up with, sort of made them radio controlled drones. That's what's really causing the fuss there in the Straits, the danger to the civilian ships. Just cut the Apache helicopters, the A-10s loose, and let them preemptively sink everything that they see down there that is not identified as, you know, either one of ours or an allied nation. You know, no questions asked. If it comes off and there's, you know, white water behind it, sink it.
Yeah.
And remove that tool from their hands.
I would agree completely. So I know that, just to let people know, part of your background was special ops in the 82nd Airborne. Am I correct about that?
That's correct. I started in the 82nd for a couple of years, then spent the rest of my career as a special forces officer, an Army Green Beret.
There's been some talk of the fact that the president, and these are not my sources, this is stuff I've read, that there's been some talk that the president's been presented with options to put some ground forces on the ground in Iran, I would assume, to try to secure whatever uranium stores they might have. How difficult an operation is that?
Well, in general, putting special ops on the ground for specific operations is that's what they do. You know, they do things behind enemy lines. They do things in small groups with only support from a long way off. And they can do that. Hitting very specific targets would work. If you're going to take over Karg Island, it's probably a better job for the Marines than the special operators. But remember, picking up that uranium is, you know, that's an engineering task,
right?
Not so much a military task, because it's not sitting there in, you know, bottles that you can throw into rucksacks or wheelbarrows or helicopters. It's buried under rubble. That's going to take more than special operators. They would have to go in, secure the site, bring in engineering equipment, excavate it and then pull out what is there. That's something I think that's probably only going to happen once we get in a permissive environment, once this the regime there in Iran is gone, and whoever takes over after them says, hey, you guys want this stuff, come in and get it. We don't want it anymore. And I think that's going to come, probably not in the next week or so, but I think there's a good opportunity that if we can get rid of more of the IRGC, both their leadership and their capabilities, it will give the citizens of Iran the opportunity they need to get rid of these guys and then have a government come into place that wants to be a responsible member of the community of nations.
President Zelensky with Ukraine is pointing to Iran and what's going on as a reason why he says there won't be a ceasefire or really any major progress in Ukraine until that whole thing is settled. Do you think that that's a legitimate reason, or is that just some sort of an excuse he's making?
No, I don't think it's an excuse, but it is, you know, the biggest, most important country in the world in both of these conflicts is the United States. Right now, the United States, well, we could do two things at once, but it does have our focus sort of split. It's a little difficult to use the president's primary negotiators in two places at once. So I think it's probably wise to get Iran settled and then turn our focus on using what the Russians and the Chinese have seen and felt through the Venezuela and Iranian operation to put the pressure on Russia to end the nonsense in Ukraine. I think it's better to do it sequentially than try and do it simultaneously.
It's a great point.
So someone who knows a lot about it says the U.S. is going back into Iran, but the president says hostilities are over. What's going on? Here's KCBS.
CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Nancy Curtis. We saw the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth testifying before the Senate, saying something to the effect of the fact that we're in a ceasefire, that basically hits the pause button, and so the whole 60-day timeline has come to a halt. I know there was pushback from Senator Tim Kaine and others. I don't even know how to unpack that argument there. Is there a pause?
You know, I think that the reality is that whether there's a pause or not, Congress has taken a war powers vote many times now, and it has always failed because Republicans have not wanted to turn on the president. So, at the end of the day, whoever's right on this front, it may be immaterial. I'll tell you that Americans certainly don't feel like there is a pause. Just this week, we saw gas prices go up 7 cents a day, 9 cents a day. We're now at levels that we haven't seen since mid-2022, and that's even before we get into the summer months when gas prices tend to go up anyway. And it's even more extreme in Europe and in Asia, which is why you saw the German chancellor this week kind of lash out at President Trump and say that he has really no plan for ending this war.
As gas prices go up and airfares go up and the cost of everything goes up because of rising fuel prices, can you tell us about pressure that might be mounting on Capitol Hill to try to get this over with?
You know, there's been pressure for quite some time, and especially because we're in an election year, and what Republicans had been hoping to run on was the economy and getting prices down, and it's no longer really possible to make that claim. It has sort of handed an issue to the Democrats, and Republicans are increasingly aware of that. Republican Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who's not running for re-election, so he, you know, could speak a little more freely, basically said flat out yesterday that it is a problem. But over here at the White House, they continue to argue that they can keep this blockade going for months. That's what it takes to pressure Iran into giving up its nuclear ambitions permanently. President Trump continues to insist that this is all worth it if, at the end of the day, Iran no longer makes any attempt to get a nuclear weapon.
Here's more on Hegseth's appearance before Congress with KCBS.
He got some very, very heated exchange. I mean, yesterday, John Garamendi from you know, the Sacramento area, you know, questioned him and started talking about how this is a quagmire, which set Hegseth off, talking about how dare you disrespect our troops when you tell them this is a quagmire. He questioned who Garamendi was rooting for, suggesting he's rooting for the enemy. Hegseth made very clear that the war, he hasn't called a war, the excursion has been a big success, and that to question that is to not understand history. And when it comes to details, he was very, very short on that.
Has the questioning pretty much gone down party lines? Friendlies on the right, hostiles on the left?
Pretty much, yes, but not completely. Notably, there were a few Republicans who said that, you know, they support the Department of Defense in general, but they did demand more oversight and said that it is your responsibility to give us more information. And this comes to a head because there is the War Powers Resolution, people refer to it as the War Powers Act, passed during Vietnam War, which says that 60 days after the president takes action, if there is no congressional authority, he must get congressional authority or begin to withdraw troops. That 60 days is tomorrow.
What'll happen remains to be seen, but let's check in with Tara Servatius and get her take on the week. Specifically, the landmark Supreme Court decision on April 29th in Louisiana versus Calais that struck down a Louisiana map with two majority black districts. The 6-3 ruling raises the bar for proving racial discrimination by demanding proof of intent to discriminate rather than just discriminatory results. Here's Tara.
Here's what Democrats are saying about that ruling.
This decision by this illegitimate Supreme Court majority strikes a blow against the Voting Rights Act and is designed to undermine the ability of communities of color all across this country to elect their candidate of choice. This isn't even really the Roberts Court. Mm-hmm. It's the Trump Court.
Yes.
And what we would expect from the Trump court is an effort to continue their scheme to suppress the vote and rig the midterm elections and beyond. Because these extremists have failed America in every possible way. So they've concluded, aided and abetted by the Trump court, that they have to cheat to win.
Yes.
That sounds really scary. It sounds like something like a Hitler Nazi dictator would do. But what actually happened yesterday? Again, this is one of those things that liberal media will use this very dense, verbose language that makes it sound like, yeah, if you don't have a law degree, you couldn't possibly understand what happened, but just Nazi Hitler stealing elections. Right. Okay, what did he say there? Black voters can no longer elect the person of their choice. That'd be bad if it were true. It's not. For the first roughly 200 years of the Republic, we followed the Constitution. It's very simple. Do math. Count the number of voters, figure out where they are, award congressional districts. Not hard stuff. If we did that, and we stopped in 1986, if we did that, Republicans right now would have 20 more seats in Congress. If we did it in a race-blind manner, as we always did. But no. What happened was they took the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, and here's what I would encourage everyone to do today, because you don't take my word for it, go pull it up. And the Democrats are saying they gutted it, made it a dead letter, destroyed it, took away minority rights, crushed their civil rights. Well, what do they do? Well, we can't draw minority districts anymore. Cool. And why were you drawing minority districts? Oh, Section 2. Okay, go read it yourself. It's online. Pull it up. Ask ChatGPT. Pull up full Section 2. Go read it. You'll notice right away something's missing. If you don't have a lot of time, text search it. The word districting, redistricting, drawing districts, it doesn't address districts, much less minority districts. As Clarence Thomas explained, he's like, you can't find it in there. It doesn't give them the ability to draw minority dominant districts where they should not be by census count. Well, how do we get here? Creative writing by the court. Liberal court decided in Gingles, hey, you know, we're going to let these Democrats draw themselves more districts than they can earn by using the Constitution, by using actual math. And they did. And so what they did was drew them for Democrats. So when he says there, this is the part that grates me the most. Hakeem Jeffries says, well, black people can't vote for the person of their choice. No, the 20 Republican districts full of voters can't vote for the people of their choice. Their civil rights were crushed. But yesterday, they were restored. It's that simple. These are not hard things. And Democrat Judiciary Committee Chief of Staff Julian Epstein, I thought, really explained it well. And it's such a simple concept.
No, I think what you're hearing from the Democrats is a lot of groveling towards the hard left. I mean, I spent a lot of time on the Voting Rights Act when I was chief counsel at Judiciary. The Voting Rights Act and the Constitution say you cannot make it harder for a black candidate to become elected, but you also cannot make it easier. And that is what essentially Justice Alito is saying.
Yeah, it's that simple, Lee.
Beyond the Voting Act decision and the conflict in Iran, the hottest topics of the week were James Comey and a royal visit from the King of England. Here's Annie Fry.
And I'm sorry to say that we British, of course, made our own small attempt at real estate redevelopment of the White House in 1814.
My recollection was that they burned it down. So that's the king at the state dinner last night, of course, at the White House. A beautiful event taking place there. And that was after a long day of the king and the queen visiting the White House speech. It was incredibly charming, I would say. And I know a lot of people are like, kings, no kings. Well, there was one in the White House yesterday. And from what I understand, there's not a king in the White House today. Let's get to a man who was there on the scene for Link Lauren. We've got a political commentator. You were part of the White House press pool yesterday. And I'm really glad to have you on with us. Your podcast is Spot On with Link Lauren. Thanks for being with us this afternoon, Link.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me. You know, I was going to make a no kings joke, but I thought maybe someone else would beat me to it.
Sorry. We did all have good. A little fun airing a part of his speech at the beginning. And of course, naturally, all the Democrats stand up and applaud. And it's like, I guess they weren't serious about that either. What was it like to be there? Very different than a normal White House press pool day, I assume, for you yesterday there with the king's presence.
Well, for me, you know, I've covered the Royals and the Trumps for about 10 years. So my friends were joking. They were like, this is manifesting at the highest level. Somehow you manifested this convergence of everyone coming together. And it was really just a beautiful moment. I think it transcended partisan politics because the partnership, obviously, the transatlantic partnership has gone in Republican administrations, Democrat administrations. It's just gone throughout history and throughout time. And so it was also really great to see two men similar in age on the world stage at the top of their game, who had such respect and admiration for each other. And I thought that was really beautiful, and all the detail and attention to detail the First Lady put in planning everything, could really feel that when you were there.
Yeah. You know, there were so many jests back and forth with full acknowledgement of the nation's history, both nation's histories, of course. Not like we had to dance around it. It was like, it is what it is. It's here, but now we're friends. And you know, my understanding is, from observation and from reporting, and you can fill us in on this a little bit as well, that there is a true friendship that exists between the king and the queen and President Trump and the First Lady, that there's a real relationship there.
Absolutely. You could feel that camaraderie. And obviously, there are so few people you can probably relate to when you're at that level of attention and press and you're in that sort of bubble, right? Whether you're the president or you're the King of England, there are so few world leaders who can really relate to that. And so I think there is this real camaraderie, and you could just feel that even all the preparation, it wasn't your typical state visit. Like sometimes, you know, they would do for other folks, but you could see that they really enjoyed having each other. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they go back to the UK. But remember when they went to Windsor Castle last year, King Charles really rolled out the red carpet and just did an incredible trip for them. And so I'm glad we reciprocated with such a beautiful moment for them as well.
Is he doing the thing that is the most frowned upon by the activist left? Is he normalizing President Trump?
Well, I don't know. I think he just has respect for him. I think King Charles knows that President Trump respects him. You know, President Trump told the story yesterday about his mother, Mary McLeod Trump, who was from Scotland, and how she really loved King Charles when he was younger and loved the Queen. May she rest in peace. And so that's something I've covered a lot for years as well, is the way his mother really respected the royals and respected the royal family. And it was just a full circle moment. I didn't see any reason for them to not go through with the trip. You know, why? Because there's a situation in Iran, because this is going on. Why cancel? You know, the king is not really an inherently political figure. And so he wasn't going to wade into all of that anyway. He maybe would touch on it delicately, but I thought he really struck a perfect balance.
Yeah, I agree. We've had a huge Supreme Court ruling yesterday regarding the Voting Rights Act in Louisiana. Guess what? You can say we're going to draw a majority-minority district and isolate people and discriminate people in order to include people. That's not how we do things here. And the Supreme Court, based in the Constitution, has said, can't do that. What does that mean going forward? We see Florida passing a map in their House and their Senate in one day to go to DeSantis, which is a brand new map, very red. Missouri here, we've seen a 7-1 map that some are suggesting could go 8-0. And then in my home state of Illinois, they think they could probably draw it so that all 18 seats are blue. We've only got three that are Republican right now. Maybe they make it worse. What happens next? Let's talk to our next guest about it. Ali Triolo joins us, the RNC Election Integrity Communications Director. So that reaction to yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on pretty much what people are looking into is congressional maps. I said earlier on the show, it's like all people are running around in a room, frenetic. Some people are cheering. Some people are pulling their hair out, panicking. What do you make of the Supreme Court ruling? And what do you expect the Republican Party to do going forward based on what they have declared?
Well, yesterday's ruling, it just reaffirms a basic constitutional principle, which is that the government cannot racially discriminate when drawing congressional maps. Democrats were segregating voters based on race. And the Supreme Court obviously came forward and said this goes against the Voting Rights Act. I mean, this, of course, is a win for common sense. We know that Democrats have been gerrymandering for decades based on all kinds of things. But obviously, yesterday was definitely a win of restoring law and order to our country.
Do you anticipate, you know, Florida takes quick action, no surprise there. I love Ron DeSantis. I wish we had one in each state, had a Ron DeSantis in each state. Is it the right move for Republicans to be looking at these congressional maps across the country and saying, do we need to take a look at what we have here and maybe make a change?
Well, look, it was within Florida's right yesterday what they did. Obviously, they were correcting what was done to them in the census. That was their prerogative. And I think what we really need to be clear about is this is finally a chance for Republicans to fight back against Democrats that has been gerrymandering this country for decades. We need to make sure that our districts actually represent communities, actually represent different areas appropriately. This lobster tail district in Virginia, that is a no. The all black district drawn in Louisiana, we know that is a complete no. So I think for us, again, Republicans are finally able to fight back on what Democrats have been doing for years. Even Barack Obama getting a state seat was because of gerrymandering. Look that up. We've been posting that article everywhere. So I would certainly say this is something that we have well documented and know has been happening for decades. That's a way that many Democrats have been able to hold on to power. I also want to point out, just going back to the hypocrisy, Hakeem Jeffries celebrating Virginia, Barack Obama saying it's the best thing ever, when we know that those proposed maps, that 10-1 split, is not indicative of Virginia voters, which is a purple state. And then 2 days later saying, oh my gosh, what the Supreme Court has done to the gerrymandering. I mean, It's clear as day, and you're just really getting me on my soapbox here.
That's all right. That's why you are here. The RNC Election Integrity Communications Director, Ali, speaking with us there. It's good to have her. There are a lot of things I think you and I have been thinking are indictable about James Comey's behavior, but the 8646 beautiful piece of art that he photographed and shared on his Instagram account seems to have gotten him in some hot water. When you consider the fact that his entire background is based on kind of working the scenes in the with Obama, with Biden, with Valerie Jarrett, maybe all of those people who are in the Obama administration when it was time to hand it over to the Trump administration, complete and total subterfuge on being able to successfully hand over the reins of power. Let's get to our guest. Greg Jarrett joins us once again, Fox News legal analyst, former defense attorney and law professor. Did it surprise you that this second indictment came through this week against James Comey?
No, not particularly. I mean, look, Comey was behind a lot over the last 10 years, beginning with the Russia hoax. You know, he has been accused of lying about leaks to the media during the Russia hoax, lying to the FISA court to obtain a search warrant and surveillance on the Trump campaign, particularly Carter Page, secretly weaponizing the FBI while denying it to Congress. You know, Comey loves to portray himself as St. James, but there's nothing virtuous about James Comey. And, you know, when he gets caught, you know, he engages in a pattern of fakery. He feigns ignorance. He plays the dummy to weasel out of wrongdoing. And, you know, in my judgment, he's a master of deceit. And so it doesn't surprise me. And look, I've said that there's going to be more than one criminal indictment against James Comey. We already saw one in Virginia, got kicked out by a judge, but that's on appeal. I expect that one to be refiled. Now North Carolina, and I think he can probably anticipate being indicted by the grand jury in South Florida.
You know, I think about what Americans like myself would like to see James Comey have to answer for. It's much more than an Instagram post and a threatening message, although I'm not opposed to that either necessarily. Do you feel as though the story that you've written so many times about with the Russia hoax and the way that they tried to impede Donald Trump to take power initially, to be able to be elected, and then when the American people chose Donald Trump to make it so there was no way that he could effectively govern. Do you trust this Department of Justice with the acting Attorney General Todd Blanche or whomever he might be replaced by? Do you trust them to get to the business of this before the next 3 years are over?
First of all, I never trust anybody in government, but
fair.
And nobody in their right mind would, given their recent track record over the last 10, 20 years. But look, Todd Blanche is a very fine attorney, former top federal prosecutor. He's one of the best defense attorneys in the nation when he took on three of the four criminal cases filed against Donald Trump, and he achieved success. So I'm going to give him a chance to see what he can do. But, you know, you're right to point out that this was, you know, a Department of Justice and the FBI back in 2016 that weaponized the law to try to stop Trump from getting elected the first time. And when that failed, they doubled down and tried to drive him from office and destroy him. It was centered around the Russia hoax, and it was all conjured up with the phony accusation that he colluded with Russia. John Brennan, then CIA director, found out about it, rushed to the White House, and in two successive meetings with President Obama, Vice President Biden, James Comey was there, Clapper was there. Instead of, Brennan disclosed the plan. Now, all of the people in that room should have been mortified. And then Comey went about using the phony dossier as a pretext to, as I say, stop Trump from getting elected and thereafter driving him from office. It, you know, was the greatest mass delusion in American political history and the dirtiest political trick ever played. And the people who did it have never been held to account.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, listen wherever you get podcasts, and smash that subscribe button.